And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm glad to be back after, what has it been, 3 weeks away? Back with wonderful guests today, Lori Fox and Gary Phillips. And if you've never listened before, then let me say that Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today, as I said, my guests are Lori Fox and Gary Phillips. First up is Lori Fox. She's the author of the autobiographical novel, My Sister from the Black Lagoon. And actually, she was on a couple of years ago with that book. Also the author of the interactive haiku poetry book, Sexy Hieroglyphics. She's published 2 chapbooks of poetry, and her work is also in several literary journals. She has been a former bookseller of both new and antiquarian books, and has been an agent with the Laurie Chester Agency for a number of years as well. She's a native of L.A., and now lives in Berkeley with her husband and their cats, and her most recent novel is The Lost Girls, published by Simon & Schuster. Hi, Lori.
Hi, it's great to be back.
Great to have you.
Coming out of the literary closet again.
Yes, well, I don't know how you do it, and I want to talk to you about how you do it.
Actually, I got so comfortable behind the scenes, so this is like my first book. It's been quite a journey, though. It's been about 5 years, this book in the making.
Well, goodness, though. Well, before we get into the other part of your life, The Lost Girls, what a wonderful book. Wendy, the character of Wendy from Peter Pan in Contemporary Times. Will you talk about that and how you came up with the idea for this?
Sure. I actually had begun another book about a woman in her 20s, and I realized I wasn't as interested in her problems, although my new book does cover about 5 women of all ages. There's a nonagenarian as well in the book. But I really wanted to tackle the complex problems of a contemporary woman at middle age, because I had also found myself in middle age. And I actually saw a picture, a single image of a woman in a rocking chair staring out a window at a great expansive sky. And she was not merely looking, but she was waiting and longing and hungering for a certain somebody to return to her. And this reminded me of the toll that waiting took on early American plains women, you know,
uh-huh.
who searched the horizon for months, years even, anticipating the return of their husbands. And I knew such a vigil can drive a person mad. And within seconds, I recognized the woman in the rocking chair as the great-granddaughter of Wendy Darling from Peter Pan, or at least that's whom she believed herself to be. So it's little known or little remembered, but in the final paragraph of Peter Pan, J.M. Barrie sets up this rather daunting chain of succession whereby the ever-forgetful Peter returns for Wendy, but he's 18, 20 years too late, and he discovers she's a grown woman with a young daughter of her own and sees that Wendy can no longer fly away with him. And so Wendy has become this crushing disappointment, and in a deft act of negotiation, she donates her daughter Jane to Peter's cause, sends Jane off to Neverland in place of herself. And then the story speeds up, and Peter returns for Jane 20 years too late, only to find Jane all grown up with a daughter of her own. And the very last line in Peter Pan, Barrie concludes with, "And thus it shall go on, as long as children are gay and innocent and heartless." So I was wowed by this idea of a succession of mothers sending their daughters off on this most bizarre tour of duty, and I just realized it had very rich psychological material and a lot of dramatic potential.
Yeah. Well, so how much did you know? Did you go into the writing of this knowing how you were going to plot it out and what was to happen? Or
absolutely not. I never see around the corner. In fact, it ruins it for me. So like a lot of authors, I actually don't know my characters' backstories until the second I write them. And the biggest revelation in this book, The Lost Girls, is Jane's backstory, because she's MIA, missing in action, for most of the book.
Yes.
And so I actually set about writing the book without even knowing what happened to her until the day I discovered it. And, you know, I was very, very excited. That was a great day. But I prefer not to know. I think when you're writing a mystery or a suspense thriller that's heavily plotted, it's important to know so you can sort of drop hints along the way. But I prefer not to know.
What about the structure in terms of you're in sort of present day, present time reality, and then you also go into Never Never Land?
Well, I should back up and say I actually know where I want to end up. I don't know the middle. I know where I'd like to begin and where I'd like to end up, although I've had surprises each time round with both books where each time my prologue became my epilogue. You know, what I thought would be the first page became the last page, and that's interesting. As far as portraying Neverland, I resisted it. I did not want a cartoonish Neverland. I know that sounds strange, but I wanted sort of a reality-based Neverland. I still wanted it to be a wondrous place, but I didn't want it to be corny.
Yes.
And so I realized that everyone in their head has their own Neverland. So I actually came up with the idea that Neverland was sort of the sum of our projections. So, in fact, all the denizens of my Neverland change the weather collectively by whatever mood they happen to have that day. And interestingly enough, the new film, Peter Pan, that came out on Christmas Day, they have Peter's moods changing the weather or affecting the weather. So, independent invention was at play there.
Interesting. And had you any idea this movie was even coming out when your book was coming out?
I found out almost by the point I had finished the book. When I embarked on this story, I do not think the movie had been green-lighted. The rights had been owned, interestingly enough, by Dodi Al-Fayed. The time of his death, I know it's been investigated now. So I don't think it was a go. So I actually just set about writing about this because it interested me, and then there's this convergence of interests. It's also the centennial of Peter Pan this year, but there's a second movie called Neverland with Johnny Depp and Kate Winslet coming out later this year. So there's another film coming out where Johnny Depp plays James Barry, the author of Peter Pan.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. Today I'm here with Lori Fox, author of The Lost Girls. How do you think that affects or will affect book sales when movies are out with themes, similar themes of books? Is that a good thing?
Well, one can always hope that there's synergy. Of course, I was worried that people might think I was jumping on the film's bandwagon, but, I had just in the privacy of my house began this story, absolutely not knowing that P.J. Hogan was going to make the film. And in fact, it was filmed in Australia, I think, just last summer, it came along much later, but I just happened to catch notice of it in the papers. One of the relatives of J.M. Barrie had complained, I believe, in the London press. She was worried that the film might be the, quote, Lolita Peter Pan. So that was the first news of a film. And I of course, went to see the film immediately. I'm a huge fan, but I have to say my Peter Pan is the 1950s Peter Pan, Mary Martin, who was in the Broadway musical, and then it was broadcast on NBC about 7 times in the 50s, and actually up through the 70s.
Interesting. Well, I love your book, and your writing is really astounding as well. As I started reading your book, I'm doing my own writing, I started to think, what's the point of even writing? I mean,
no.
Writing is so incredible. What's the point?
I feel like we all feel like we're just getting our training wheels, I mean, in fact, when you sit down for a second or third book, you realize, you're not cocky in the least, you realize you haven't a clue. You have to start all over again. When I finished the first book, I was so excited that I had found the time. I had this over-the-top life as a literary agent. I carved away, chipped away at the first book, paragraph by paragraph, only on Saturday mornings for maybe 2 hours at a time. So I never imagined it would amount to a three-dimensional book-shaped object. So when it did, I went around telling everyone else who had over-the-top jobs that they could do it. You know, I was very much the cheerleader. But when I sat down to write The Lost Girls, again, I had forgotten how to be ruthless with my time. The very message I'd been giving other people,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't follow myself. So it actually took me a while to pick up steam.
Mm. Well, how do you do that? You are a literary agent. You're dealing with other people's material during the week, I would imagine, and how do you then take all that, put it away, and focus only on your own?
At first, I was worried that other people's stories would crowd my brain, and also that some of the less than stellar writing I might come across would seep into my brain at night. But that was very silly. In fact, I tend not to. Well, I'm very, very busy working with my own clients, so their stories I'm very close to, but I don't do any outside reading. I read an incredible number of magazines because I need my reading fix, but I do stay away from outside material. You know, when people come up to you and they say, oh, have you read this book or that book? I had a little chip on the shoulder because I really felt that I had to focus just on this story. But I also noticed that there's really no danger from reading writing that you think has problems because you learn so much. I work very closely as a developmental and line editor with a lot of my fiction clients, and I think that's the single most activity that's improved my own writing because you learn to pinpoint what's not working. On the other hand, I'm blessed with a wonderful group of editors who attack my own work and read me the riot act. So,
yes.
I mean, I absolutely go through the same process. My work is, you know, goes through the ringer and umpteenth revisions. So, you know, I'm extremely humble, and I bring in my husband at the last minute to clean up the syntax.
Interesting. So in terms of The Lost Girls and what we read now, how say did the first the initial drafts differ?
I think that much of it is on the page. I worked to even out the tone. I was told that my tone veered from zany to poignant, you know, within a single page. And in fact, Barbara, that's how I experienced life. So it actually was me at my most honest. But I understood that might be a little rough on the reader, so I thought, okay, I'll do my best, but to tell you the truth, I think it still veers, but that's because I think that's what life is like. It's very absurd, you know, you turn on news of the war, and I do believe there's still war going on, even though they say that it's finished, and then you try to work on your more imaginative work. I still work only on the weekends. Last time round, I worked on a laptop in public, and I wrote the entire book in public, and I think we talked a little bit
yes.
about that. This time, I trained myself to work in my bed. That was a coup for me, personal coup.
Now, part of that, though, is not being totally well, yeah?
Totally well?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do wrestle with a very challenging autoimmune illness called fibromyalgia that affects about 6 million people, far more than chronic fatigue syndrome,
yes.
although it's a cousin of chronic fatigue. And it's physically painful for me to write sometimes. I have serious neck and shoulder pain like a lot of people, but I also contend with devastating fatigue from 1 hour to the next, so I can literally gallop up the stairs and then the next hour find myself sort of crawling up the stairs. And a lot more people are cognizant of this ever since Laura Hillenbrand
yes.
spoke openly about her chronic fatigue syndrome and wrote about it in The New Yorker. So it's true. I was banished to my bedroom a great many times when I wanted to be out in the world writing. And on the other hand, you know, I think writing and creativity and illness go hand in hand. So I don't ever have a oh, poor me attitude. I just, in fact, kind of use what I call a brain fog, which is a to the cognizant fuzziness, to not judge what I do. So that's one of the greater blessings of having fatigue. You don't criticize yourself while you're in the act of writing. You know, later on I step back and I can be just as hard on myself as anyone, but while I'm writing I don't step in every third line and you know, whip myself. So yeah. Because I write in a very intuitive state. I really am not very clear about what's going on, and that's why I think a lot of readers can tell, have a greater handle on my work than I do, probably.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting because the book is so upbeat, one would never think this is written by somebody in bed who is not feeling too good today.
Thank
you.
It's sort of combined some of my favorite elements, but, you know, one of my favorite things, when I first started out, I had to think about what it would be like for all these girls that James Berry alluded to in the last paragraph who are sent off by their mothers. And I realized, in fact, they all share the same first boyfriend. And, you know, how twisted is that? If you had the same first boyfriend as your grandmother, your great-grandmother, your mother, and even your daughter, that would set up a lot of drama in the household, you know. So I think that really, that idea sort of sent me to the page, you know. I was so interested to understand what that would be like, you know, the jealousies and the sort of, you know, thorny relationships between mothers and daughters. So it's essentially a mother-daughter book, although a lot of people have asked me about whether it's mostly about the women who marry these Peter Pan-like characters.
Right. What about that? Because you have the men and boys who don't seem to grow up exactly.
I have a lot of that, I realize, but it's not an angry book. And the reason for that is that I'm not one of those women who has a lot of residual anger about, you know, quote, irresponsible man or man-child type males. I actually enjoy my friends, my male friends, who are Peter Pan-like now because I don't have to live with them.
Yeah.
So I actually am drawn toward them because if I want to have an upbeat time, I'll give them a call. Usually they're extremely charismatic and playful. And, you know, life is deadly serious most of the time. I have had my share of experience with men who weren't necessarily responsible, but it's a mixed bag. I think, you know, you get the good stuff with the bad stuff. So I had a boyfriend who panicked, for instance, when he had to look for a job in the Sunday classified.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, we had great adventures, very creative adventures together. And he was a composer, like Freeman in my novel. And so it was balanced. You know, at some point something's got to give. If you're going to have a long-term relationship, you want someone who takes out the garbage and so forth. But I really don't have a lot of anger. I have, ever since this book has come out, though, I have spoken to several women in their 20s who say, you know, they're going through this right now. Although some women have confessed to me that they are Peter Pan-like. And in Jungian terms, there's pueriternis, the eternal youth, and puellas, the female version of the puer.
Interesting. So, I didn't know that.
So there are women who, you know, enjoy staying childlike as long as they can possibly manage it.
Hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Lori Fox, author of The Lost Girls. I want to, before we forget, I want to give your website, and also, I think you're doing some readings down this way?
I am. I'm reading at Dutton's in Brentwood on a Monday, and I'm going to also be at Roman's in Pasadena at 1 p.m. on this Saturday, both signing The Lost Girls, but also offering a publishing workshop.
Oh.
And then I'll be at Warwick's Books on Tuesday night in La Jolla.
Okay.
And it's all on, it's very embarrassing to have a shameless website that's all about me, but that's new for me.
It's
very
cute.
LoriFox.com.
It's very cute.
Thank
you. Your website. Oh, will you read to us for, you know, a minute or so?
I'd like
to. Give our readers, listeners a taste.
I'll just read the first page of the prologue.
Okay.
To give you an introduction to my protagonist. My contemporary Wendy is the great-great-granddaughter of the original Wendy Darling, and she lives in the hills of Berkeley, California, where I live now. And the book starts when she's 42 years old, and this is in her voice. I was warned against it, lectured, teased, even threatened, but it was bound to happen. I grew up. I grew up with purpose, I grew up with alacrity, with an excess of insolence and a daring lack of contrition. In so doing, I made a small dent in the heart of a young man, a boy really, whom I left behind in my drive towards self-knowledge and sophistication. For all I know, to this day he remains disappointed in me and defiantly, stubbornly young. I paid dearly for my act. I married well. I bore and raised a ravishing daughter. Then I lost both husband and daughter to inner worlds that I am not equipped to enter. Which is why most nights I sit alone at my window, the fabled storyteller with a dearth of stories to tell the children she meets. For the only tale left is too hideous to confess, full of adult heartbreak, adult wistfulness. You could say mine is a story with a hook. A hook to a boy who hardly exists anymore, except in glimpses of my husband, in piss-poor dreams of flying around rooms like a damned fairy, in the stranglehold the past has on the imagination. When I was 13, I seriously believed that if I conjured up happy thoughts, I could float above the world. This belief had a poetic logic that wasn't lost on me. Nowadays, the rare happy thought occurs to me as I look out at the San Francisco Bay. I meditate on lifting off, then touching down, on losing and finding myself in one fell swoop. And then I recall a boy who wanted too much from life, a grown man who wanted too little from me, the pressing needs of a dozen young boys. Such unhappy thoughts send my spirits crashing, a shame because when I was 13, I was chock full of possibility. I was magic incarnate. They called me the Wendy Bird, a creature admired by one and all. And flying was as natural to me then as sitting is now.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Beautiful, beautiful writing.
Thank you.
Gosh, we're at the end of our time. I wonder if you would offer any last words on publishing fiction these days when so many agents and those in publishing say it's one of the hardest things to sell.
Well, I'm always a sort of cheery voice on panels because I truly want people to keep the faith. There's a lot of talk these days about having a national platform and being published in all the right magazines. But from my point of view, you know, good work usually rises to the top. It can take many, many years. I've sold several works of fiction from authors or of authors who had published a single story or not one story at all. In fact, they did not come with all the requisite credentials, but it was their work that spoke loudly for them. So it is a long haul. It tries your patience. So I would say to review your intentions. If it's to get, you know, rich and famous, that's not going to carry you 10, 20 years. But if your interest is in the craft itself and in doing good work, I do think you'll get there. So I wish everyone well.
You are a cheery voice. I like that.
I know. I don't mean to be a Pollyanna, but what else is there to say? You know, I really think I'm in the same boat with everyone else. You know, I realize that the business is a tough business. So you really have to think about your intentions over the long haul.
Yes. Thank you so much for being with us. And maybe when this comes out in paperback, you can come back.
I'd love to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
That was Lori Fox speaking to us from Berkeley. And her book again is The Lost Girls, published by Simon & Schuster. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with Gary Phillips. Don't go anywhere. And hello again. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and In case you weren't with us for the first half, Writers on Writing features authors, editors, and literary agents talking about the art and business of writing. And we are broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. And the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California Regents. We are back with Gary Phillips, author of Bangers. Gary writes in several mediums, from novels to screenplays to comic books. His current projects include Midnight Mover, a four-part crime story for Oni Comics set in L.A.'s porn world, and The Perpetrators, an action-adventure novella, now out from Ugly Town Publishing. And Beginner's Luck, a Martha Chaney short story, is in the Shades of Black anthology from Berkeley Prime Crime. And as I mentioned at the beginning, his latest novel is Bangers, published by Kensington. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to talk to you again. I think the last time we talked was at Borders.
I believe it was a panel
a couple years ago.
Yes, it was.
Gosh. You know, I wonder if you would tell our listeners how Bangers came about. What was the genesis for this book?
Well, the book is a look at, which is now, I suppose, somewhat familiar territory, but it's a look at an elite police unit operating in a neighborhood in Los Angeles, modeled somewhat on the PICO Union, so modeled somewhat on the Rampart scandal, but also it takes into account, I think, previous indelicacies committed by not only the LAPD but other police departments. But really, it's an old story because really it's a story about power. It's about what does it do to people who, through you know various means, some mean well and some don't mean well, and what does that do to them? What does it do to them in situations where they can practice a certain amount of autonomy, and the rationale is to get the job done, and so the question is at what cost.
Interesting. Now, when you're taking something that, say, happened and you're creating fiction from it,
yeah,
maybe you're using it as sort of a base and
right,
adding to the stew, how much research do you feel you need to do, or do you even concern yourself with research?
Well, I do to the extent that things like being clear on what kind of Berettas the LAPD uses or what kind of squad cars they use, that kind of thing I feel the need to do research on, to be clear about, just to add some weight, some verisimilitude to the story. But because I actually do create a different kind of neighborhood, I call it Venice Heights in the book, therefore, you know, it gives you more leeway to put in other aspects maybe that you take from either this city or from other cities, or obviously create things out of whole cloth. So to some degree it's a mixture, but it has to have, I think, enough of a ring, enough of a kind of gravitas that hopefully resonates with the reader. But, you know, as I said, again, it's a question of combining that research with, of course, hopefully, characters that people want to possibly not emulate, but at least find out about.
Sure. So then what comes first? Does the character come first, or does the story?
Well, in this case, the story came first, or at least the springboard for the story being the revelations around Rampart, but also because I sort of know some of the folks peripherally involved in the story, or involved in the bigger story, the scandal, and so that helped in terms of some material that wasn't in the public or wasn't in the paper or the press, and I thought, well, that's interesting. I could use some of that or take some of that and go off from that and use it to make this other story, because the story really, as I said, it's about this elite unit, but it's also about politics, big city politics, in that the DA who's out to bust this squad is also running for mayor, so for her it's a feather in her cap if she should be able to bust the squad and therefore get some points up in the mayor's race. So it's also about people who are angling for different things, who want different things, and what are they doing to accomplish that.
Yeah, interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here today with Gary Phillips, author of Bangers, published by Kensington. Then how much do you know? How much do you know going into this in terms of, say, the dramatic arc of your story? Do you know the ending when you begin?
Well, yeah, this is always a variance among writers. I tend to work from an outline. I work from a fairly detailed outline, not particularly long, although certainly I guess the question would be that I try to cover the major beats and the major points in the story. So for me, I do that as a way to get started. Now, I might vary, and I invariably do vary from the outline as I go along, although generally speaking, the ending stays the same. But I actually, now that I, but if I'm pressed on this, and actually even in particular in this story in Bangers, the ending actually was a little more bleak than I had intended.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
it seemed like a logical conclusion to where everything was going.
Sure. I really like the last line of the book. I find it it's not one of those last lines that sums everything up. It's
right.
Just sort of they're carrying on.
Right.
You know. But in terms of what I see here before me in the finished novel and what you started with, how close is this? How much revision did it go through?
Well, that's interesting. I suppose there's a lot of revision that happens just in your head as you're writing it. I tend to, just the mechanics of it, I tend to rewrite as I write so that I will write 50 or 60 pages, and then I will edit those pages, as I sort of get inspired, or I think, well, does that scene really work, or maybe we should follow this character a little bit more in this area here. I will then sort of tinker with that, and then go forward again, and get another bulk of pages done, and again sort of stop and go back through and edit and try to correct for syntax and typos and that grammar and that kind of thing, but also look to the story, look to where things are going with the characters. So that usually what happens is by the time I get to the end, the last pages, I have essentially not rewritten the whole book, but I've certainly redone or reshifted and moved some things around so that when I get to that stage and I go back through again and read, and then I'm again might do tinker and fool with it, but then I'm pretty much done.
Hmm. And then what happens then when you turn it in and your editor has a look? Do you in terms of the editing process,
right.
I guess is what I'm wondering, how do you feel about suggestions that come forth, or will they just leave your work alone and trust that you just know what you're doing?
Well, it varies. It certainly varies from book to book, project to project. In this case, there was very little content editing. There was, I thought, very good copy editing, very good line edits, and some things we went back and forth on in terms of cleaning up some grammatical stuff. But very little content, now, as opposed to, let's say, my previous book, well, this novella that I had out last year, The Perpetrators, which even though it's, in a lot of ways, it's a much different structural kind of novel, because it's very much an action-adventure, very much kind of a kind of screenplay kind of novel. I went through a pretty hefty rewrite on it, but I thought it was a good rewrite. In other words, I got some real good comments from the young men who run Ugly Town, a small press here in L.A., and I thought they were excellent comments, in fact, and then proceeded to do the rewrite. So generally speaking, I don't know, all writers wax and wane, I think, on this notion of editing and rewriting and how much do you do and how much is enough. And 'cause at some point, I suppose, for me, either the piece, the story, or the novel, or whatever it is, the screenplay is what it is, and at some point I can't write it anymore. So it probably either fails or flies on that. On the other hand, though, I must say, there are certainly times when I get comments from the editor that I find them to be very very helpful, very insightful, and things, and we'll lose a scene because. Well, does that scene really work? And, well, no, it doesn't. So, and well, you know, and I would agree with that. So, I don't know, it's a give and take. It's a give and take process.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm speaking with Gary Phillips, author of Bangers, here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Wanted to ask you about going from, say, writing short stories to novels, mm-hmm. to novellas, to screenplays, to comic books, all different mediums.
Right.
How is that for you? When you get an idea, does it come as, in terms of this will fit a comic book,
right,
this will fit a novel,
right.
Or
what medium?
Yeah, what,
right.
What happens?
Sometimes it's just because I owe a book to a publisher, so therefore it has to be a book because I have to finish it as a book. But it's funny. I think about this more now, having gotten a little bit more into script writing, and of course the structure and the discipline for script writing is so different than writing a story, because of course scripts are much leaner, much more shorthand than a book. Although, you know, even in a book, I think the particularly writing in the mystery and crime genre, you still have to as they say, show not tell. Even though which is kind of odd considering you have a lot more words to play with, and certainly you can go much more into the interior landscape of your characters than certainly you're allowed to do in a movie or a screenplay. So I think about that in the context of, well, is the idea exciting to me? And then I do try to, I suppose, compartmentalize in my head. Well, best may not be the correct adjective here, but what is in fact the most interesting or the most at least exciting way for me as the writer to present that idea? So maybe it is as a novel, maybe it is as a screenplay that you go to try to sell, or maybe it is as a short story, because maybe the idea is not such that, for instance, I've just been working on a short story. So, you know, short stories have to have a beginning, middle, and end, and short stories are a great discipline, I think, for figuring out how to write longer, because, of course, you have to compact everything down. But is the idea enough so that it can sustain itself? Some ideas may not be ideas that you can stretch into a novel. Yeah. Maybe they are only ideas that, because they're small, but that's fine. And maybe they should only be a short story. They should only be a small story.
Hmm. Is the novel form the most interesting to you?
Well, yes, it's also the most daunting. In fact, as you were mentioning with your previous guest, the whole aspect of selling fiction now, mm-hmm. and the market for it, such that it is, somewhat of a roller coaster, is both, of course, infuriating for you as the writer, but in the end, it's the novels that will last, and the novels that will be there after we're long gone, for good or bad. So there's a lot to be said for that. There's a lot to be said for being able to stretch out and to flex. But having said that, it also suggests that I know for me as a writer, and I think all writers think about this, is also to try to start to do other kinds of material, other kinds of approaches, because you don't want to repeat yourself.
Yeah. What do you think about that, though, in terms of fiction being difficult to sell? And sometimes you hear, oh, it's more difficult to sell now than ever.
Than ever, right.
What do you think about all that?
Well,
and how does it affect you?
You can't help but have that on your mind. You can't help but reflect on that. On the other hand, writing is such a therapy that you have to still tell these stories, or at least I think if you're a writer, you have to tell these stories. You have to tell the stories that you yourself would want to read, and you can't. I mean, it's Pollyannish to say, well, you can't let that affect you, when in fact, well, you know, for me, I have, you know, we have kids in high school and car notes and house payments and all that, so that's all real. That's all there.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, you can't let it dictate the story you want to tell. And if it's the novel, whatever that novel is, be it so-called genre or mainstream, and I'm not. That's a whole other debate about what those topic areas, what those subjects mean. You still have to tell the story you want to tell, and hopefully that book will find an audience. The reality being, of course, I think works can get published. The question, partly though, is do those works find the audience that those works deserve?
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us to the idea, or it's not even an idea, to the fact of marketing and networking.
Right.
How important is it? How important is it to you?
Oh, you know, I used to be sort of burning up with that. I mean, in terms of, and I still do. I mean, I certainly go, there's various mystery conventions throughout the year, and I go to a couple of them, and but I probably go to less of them now. But I have found that because I suppose enjoy an eclectic readership. I don't know if it's not a huge readership, but it's an eclectic readership. So I get to go to some college campuses and go to other kinds of venues, and I like that. I appreciate that because I think it obviously reaches out to people who wouldn't necessarily know my work, and you know, be able to engage the public on that level. So I think those things are good. The whole business of the networking and, you know, I've got to send out X amount of postcards or I've got to do X amount of emails and stuff. I don't know. I do some of that. It's not that I don't. I have a website, and so I'm not indifferent to any of that. But I suppose in the end, you know, it drains you so much and it consumes so much of your time that it just splits you off in so many different ways when, in fact, your job as the writer is to write. Unfortunately, the business of writing intrudes, and it's a reality, but I suppose the point being that you can't let it consume you from the creative aspect.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here with Gary Phillips, author of Bangers. Will you read to us?
I will, and bearing in mind the admonishment to keep it G-rated, because I certainly write in the hard-boiled genre, I will substitute some words here.
Thank you very much.
In this brief passage, this passage is kind of early on in the book, and Santillan and Cortese, who are our two main characters, the two guys who are the leaders of this squad of cops, are driving to a destination because they're looking for a particular suspect. The two laughed softly. Santillan sped through an intersection against the light, turning red. In less than 15 minutes, the Malibu was rolling through the core of the Venice Heights section, a dense 12-mile square area just west of downtown. The Heights, or V-12 as the gang members called it, was like a lot of neighborhoods that had gone through various ethnographic transitions over the years. There was still a Greek restaurant that did overflow business during the week, but the tailor shop next to it had been replaced in the last 3 years with a carniceria complete with a full-scale plastic bull statue on its roof. There was also leftovers of the black businesses that used to populate the landscape, to be sure the staple of African-American mom and pop outlets. The three B's of barber, beauty, and barbecues were not as plentiful these days anywhere in L.A. But the West Texas Palace of Savory Meats, a rib and hot links joint of citywide fame, was still owned and operated by a family who'd been around since Santillan had been a kid. The Lanceliers, Cortese nodded, as a seven-story building of a design from the Beaux-Arts area. Behind the structure, the crosstown MTA subway train thundered along the elevated tracks. And there's Big T. Santillan made a left and guided the car toward a haphazard row of cypress trees alongside an auto parts store. He parked, and the two alighted from the vehicle. "Sup, Santillan," addressed Theo Big T. Holton. He was an imposing black man, a little over 6'1", with a wide beer truck carriage of a body. He was always in a rumpled suit and one of his stingy brim hats jammed over the cube of his head. "My crackhead snitch says Via slicked back into town from El Paso last night. Says this meet was going has something to do with the Nines and the Baja Cartel setting up a new thing." He took off his hat and scratched at his graying, short-cropped thatch. Santillan got the Malibu's trunk open to reveal several 870 semi-automatic shotguns and zipper duffel bags. "About what?" "Nobody except them locals up there in Little Puppet's crib," he pointed at the apartment house, "know for sure. But me and Ron figure it's tied to what went down 3 days ago. The police chief of Juarez, across from El Paso, was driving back from Mass in his supposedly bulletproof Suburban. The chief was cut down by heavy-duty ordnance a short two blocks from his headquarters. The newspeaker was Barry Ronk Culhane. He was Holton's running buddy, a naturally slender individual who maintained a serious regime of weights and bulking powders. His face was bristling with whiskers, and his thinning blonde hair glistened with a recent application of Rogaine. Villa was made as one of the shooters. Cortese racked the 12-gauge he'd removed from the Malibu's trunk. Culhane shook his head vigorously. "Not a positive, no, but we understand our boy was down there to have a face-to-face with Rosario Del Fuego." "The El Paso cops have issued on all points for him," Culhane added. "So let's go ask him," a fifth man spoke. Alvaro Acosta was in his dark blue patrolman's uniform. The younger man's black hair was cut military precise, and the brown skin of his face was unblemished. "Okay, Mr. Riga, we will." Santillan shut the trunk, then reconsidered and extracted two mini Astro walkie-talkies out of the duffels. He also clipped a shell carrier onto his belt. He used his back pocket for his two-way. He handed the other one to Culhane. "Let's be cautious and cool," he said. Ron Culhane took the instrument and sniffed the air. "Smells like testosterone."
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That was Gary Phillips reading from Bangers, published by Kensington. I wanted to ask you a question. It's from, actually, it came up in reading an interview with you, mm-hmm. and that is that your wife reads your books after they're published. I'm very curious about that. Why is that?
Well, now I guess it's become a kind of superstition on my part. It's funny how that started. I suppose it has little to do with ego, mostly to do with insecurity. And so given that, and my wife is a well-read person, so I suppose just being very trepidatious initially. And so now, over a period of time, it's just gotten to the stage where I suppose it's just become a kind of, as I said, a kind of tradition here in the house, so that I present her with the books afterward, as opposed to, I guess maybe cause partly because I'm also scared of her input as I get into the book, because I might have to change it too much.
No, I mean, I know so many writers who perhaps when they started writing, their spouses or significant others would read their stuff, and as they went on, they said, you know what, we'll stay together longer if you just read it later.
There we go.
Yeah. Gosh, we're at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers struggling along or listening to the show.
Well, you know, the advice is always the same, and it's I'm sure it's, you know, it's mantra. It's repeated over and over again, but, you know, the only way to write is to write, right? The only way to do it is to sit down and bang that story out, and then, of course, this is why the good Lord invented rewriting, is to go back into it. And hone it and shape it and mess with it and retool it the best you can, but there is no other secret. Unfortunately, there is no other way.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Barbara,
for taking the time, and gosh, continued luck on your writing.
Well, I appreciate
and
that.
And bangers especially.
All right, now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye bye.
That was Gary Phillips speaking to us from Los Angeles, and again, his novel is Bangers, and his website is, let me get this right, gnphillips.com. And if for some reason that doesn't work, write to me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net, and I will connect you up with the right website. Actually, it's G.D. Phillips. I'm looking at the back of his book, G.D.P.H.I.L.L.I.P.S.com. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can visit my website at writersonwriting.com, and there you can email me to be on my weekly email list where I send out notices and tell you who's going to be on the show, and most of the time I spell everybody's name and their title of their books correctly when I'm lucky. I would like to leave you with a quote by Rita Mae Brown, who said, "Creativity comes from trust. Trust your instincts. And never hope more than you work." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and until next week.